You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about a new effort to preserve the Midwest's musical past by preserving folk music from Wisconsin indigenous and immigrant groups.
First, movements out to raise the minimum wage and address income inequality are signs that a new working class America is becoming a more powerful player on the national stage, according to our next guest.
She says the new working class looks different than yesterday's workers in manufacturing. It's a new group with far more women and racially diverse people than before, working often in the service industry. And our guest says they have the power to transform the social and economic structures in the whole country.
Tamara Drought is with us now. She's the vice president of the national think tank Demos and the author of the new book called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Tamara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've said that the changes to life for the working class are part of what drove you to write this book. Can you tell us a little more about your family's history?
Sure. So I grew up in a household where neither of my parents went to college. My dad worked at the local steel factory in Middletown, Ohio for 29 years, and my mom was ultimately became the office manager at a local orthodontist office. And, you know, despite not having college degrees, we were able to really achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And by that, I mean a level of economic security from decent wages to health care benefits. We always had enough food in the house. We even took yearly vacations down to Myrtle Beach. And most importantly, they were able to pay full freight for me to go to Ohio University, which is a state university. And I left in 4 years without any debt. And I really contrast that with today's working class, which, you know, as you said in the setup, the service sector class, working class, is much more female and much more people of color. And as we shifted from a working class that made stuff to one that serves people and one that is much more female and much more racially diverse, we've had a working class that has been really marginalized and devalued and shut out of our public debate.
Well, as you say that, that working class of decades ago that made stuff, that working class was a powerful force to be reckoned with politically. That cloud has waned over the years. And in your book, you say that now there is more working class solidarity in the United States than at any time since the 1970s. But as we look at divisions of race, of ideology, alongside the decline of unions in many places, including Wisconsin, how can you make that case?
Yeah, so, you know, I spend a whole chapter looking at the new organizing of and by and for the working class across the country, from Austin, Texas, to Seattle, Washington, to Kansas City, Missouri, and also at the national movements that are much more familiar to all of us, Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers, you know, which are the undocumented immigrants who have been pushing for better immigration policy as well as in-state tuition. And then, of course, Fight for 15. And I think these are enormous movements that have, at their best, really brought new cross-class, cross-race alliances in a way that we haven't seen since the heyday of the labor movement. And even then, you know, the labor movement at its best was really a cross-racial alliance in the effort for economic and racial justice. At its worst, it wasn't. But these new movements, I think, are showing that it's tough work, but that solidarity can be built to achieve real economic and racial justice, and that those two issues are deeply, deeply intertwined.
Well, talking about the definition of this new working class, we've mentioned women, people of color. Who else is in this new working class?
So there's certainly still plenty of white people in the working class. I define working class in the book as people who are in the labor market without four-year college degrees. And I chose that cutoff for a couple reasons. But the most important is that if you look at the quality of life in terms of job quality, the amount you earn, whether you have retirement savings, whether you can afford to send your kids to college, the reality is that over the last three decades, there has been a sharp divergence in those being able to attain those, you know, middle class factors of life between people who have college degrees and people who don't. It is becoming a much sharper dividing line in our society. So that's why I define working class that way.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now, vice president of the national think tank Demos and the author of the new book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And you've said that in a lot of cases, the working class in general is more progressive than its college-educated counterparts. Where do you see that most clearly?
You see the progressiveness of the working class really on economic policy issues, particularly on questions about whether everybody should be able to go to college, a public college, and leave without any debt, on whether the minimum wage should be high enough so that full-time workers don't live in poverty, on questions of how to raise revenue in this country to pay for things that would benefit all of us. You see much more support for raising taxes among the richest among us. So it's really on economic policy issues that you have a working class that is much more hungry, much more supportive for a more active role for government in ensuring that we have decent living standards in this country.
So economics is one point of agreement. Where does it break down a little bit and start to diverge?
Yeah, so this is where it really diverges, especially among the white working class, and that is on issues of race and on issues of immigration policy. And I think, you know, if we look at the ascendancy of Donald Trump's campaign, it really is based on, you know, decades of polling about the white working class. He's blending an economic populism with a very strong anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist appeal. And that comes straight out of the polling data that we see with the white working class.
And so how does that play out? If you're talking about a new working class that you see poised to exert a lot of power on policy and politics, they have to work together, don't they? So which wins out when different systems and viewpoints come into play?
Well, I think, you know, it's not to say that there are not white working class people who are deeply progressive and tend to vote Democratic. That has always been the case, and it's still the case. My argument is that this new working class is more racially diverse than the old working class. And I think with that development, we do have a working class as a whole that is more progressive than previous working class voters.
And yet this working class isn't yet wielding the kind of influence you're talking about. So what is standing in its way?
Yeah, I think there's some really important challenges, and they're big challenges. I think building a larger movement means tackling the legacy of racism in this country, because I think that the working class has really been marginalized because so much of the work being done today is being done by people of color, particularly immigrants. I think it also, a huge challenge is what I talk about in the book is social distance. Today, you know, if you look at the composition of the top staffers in Congress or our journalists, they are by and large now coming from pretty well-heeled, privileged households. And the reality is our sort of cultural news and policymakers, you know, often their only interaction with the working class is in commercial transactions. So those are two really big challenges. And I think it is possible that these movements will figure out ways to navigate those and turn those challenges into opportunities, but they're significant. But I think as we see this week on April 14th is going to be another huge day of action by the Fight for 15. In just 3 years, they have elevated the issue of inequality and poor job quality among fast food and retail and adjunct faculty and home health workers. And, you know, already delivered millions of raises through minimum wage increases, most recently in California and New York. So I think momentum is building, and as, you know, success is contagious. As we see real success in getting policy changes and in changing the political debate, more and more people are going to join in this fight.
Do you see the things you're talking about coming into play with any of the presidential campaigns right now? Is anybody right now, does anybody have the ear of the working class and vice versa?
I think that Absolutely. I think that you see trade, which is particularly important to working class voters, has been something that both the Democratic nominees and the Republican nominees have talked a lot about. And I don't think anybody headed into this election would have thought that trade was going to be one of the signature economic issues we're talking about. But it is, and I think it's great that it is. We see the minimum wage is also, at least on the Democratic side, a big part of the Democratic platform, and then the call for college affordability, which is very important to working class voters who, you know, get up and go to jobs and punch in so they can give their kids a better life. And that means really getting serious about making public college affordable again.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now. Her new book is called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think this new working class will ever have the political clout of the old working class in the heyday of unions, or is it too divided to be a unified force? What do you think is keeping some members of the working class from turning out at the polls? And do you work at one of these service jobs our guest is talking about? Do you feel motivated to participate in politics or left out, maybe by both parties? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about what might come next for the working class with Tamara Drought right now. Her new book is called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest that working class America, while may not look like it has a lot of influence now, is a sleeping giant that will have influence in the near and mid-future? Are you working class? Do you consider yourself working class, how do you see politics? What issues are most important to you? Is there someone, a party, a politician who you think represents you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Lynn with us first in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Veronica, and hello to your guest, Tamara. I am the great-granddaughter of a union martyr. And so it's in my blood. It's in my blood. And nothing was given to us by the corporations. Nothing was given. Lives were lost. I'm not suggesting we go back to that. I'm suggesting that we remember that and keep it in our hearts when we cast our votes, when we go shopping. It's really important that we do not lose the middle class dream.
Lynn, thank you so much for that call. And Lynn has a long history of unions. You can hear that. She's talking about remembering that the strand of what unions stood for and what the middle class was in her family's heyday. But is that something that still resonates today, Tamara, the way that it used to, or could it still in the future?
Yeah, and I really appreciate those sentiments because I think Lynn's exactly right. One of the things we have forgotten is how central unions were to the growth of the middle class in this country. And we take for granted that actual real blood was shed and lives were lost to fight for the right for workers to be able to organize their workplace. And, you know, as we've seen, and it's, you know, happening in Wisconsin, you know, this battle over the right to work laws, we've had such an erosion of labor law in this country where it is much more difficult to unionize your workplace today than back in the 50s. Corporations, you know, arm themselves with high-priced consultants to try and beat back union efforts as soon as there's any whiff that employees are trying to win collective bargaining rights. So I really appreciate her bringing back the fight and appreciating that this was a huge fight that was fought, and we're losing it right now, and it's important that we don't let it go because economic democracy is a central piece of our overall democracy in this country.
But is the power of the union, is it ever going to be resurrected, or are you seeing that kind of sentiment that Lynn is expressing taking a different form going forward?
Well, I think what we're seeing is lots of innovation. I think if you look at the Fight for 15, which has been, you know, almost entirely funded by the SEIU, is a real acknowledgement by the union that it needs to do things differently. So far, that hasn't resulted in any new union members, but it has resulted in significant raises for millions of people in this country. So, you know, that's the kind of social activism that unions have played throughout the history of this country. You know, they're the ones that got us Medicare and the weekend and minimum wage to begin with. So I think that it's vitally important that we both try and beat back what has become a viral strain of anti-unionism in this country, but that we also be at the same time innovating and finding ways to organize outside of the formal union structure.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now, vice president of the national think tank Demos and author of the new book Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And we'll go back to our calls now and take one next from Ken in Cambridge. Ken, hello.
Hi there. I'm kind of on the other side of the spectrum. You guys are forgetting about the small business owner. He can't afford $15 an hour. So these people in California are actually losing their jobs. They're either being cut, staff is being cut, going into automation. You know, and you try and sell a burger, how many more burgers you got to sell to make $15 an hour versus $8 an hour?
Ken, appreciate your call. And Ken's worried there about small businesses who would be maybe the least likely or least able to afford a $15 minimum wage in that. Does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The argument about this will be too hard for small businesses is something that has been used time and time again as sort of a wedge to argue against paying employees actually what they should be paid for the work they do. So I think no studies have shown that there's been a decimation of small businesses because of minimum wage laws. Oftentimes it's small businesses that are leading the way in terms of paying their workers much better pay, providing better benefits than some of the big box retailers or fast food chains. So I think, you know, small business is not a monolith by any means, but this creates a level playing field. Everybody will be paying the same wages, and we can also rest assured that the cost of a hamburger is not going to triple in order to pay for this rate. It will go up a modest amount, but honestly, the purchasing power that people will have thanks to the $15 wage will more than offset any price increase in the cost of a hamburger.
And we're going to go next to Jill. Jill's joining us in Rhinelander. Jill, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have two comments. I remember back in the day when Ronald Reagan was our president, he said he was going to change this to a service economy. And then he also purported the trickle-down theory. I guess I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay, Jill, thanks for that. And Tamara, what about the service economy? Does that matter when we're talking about the working class?
Well, I think it matters in that there's nothing inherent about the shift from making stuff to serving people that means that we had to completely degrade the living standards for the people that do those jobs. What happened was, at the time, three things happened. We saw the loss of union density as manufacturing jobs got shipped overseas. We have the backlash to the civil rights movement and the women's movement in terms of our political debate. So we now have levels of occupational segregation that have been left unchanged since 1980, where the lowest paid jobs are today still done primarily by people of color, and at the bottom is women of color. So I think there's nothing inherent about the service sector economy that these can't be good-paying jobs, but as the other caller said, the demand has to be made, and I think that's what's so beautiful about what we're seeing right now. Demands are being made from the Dreamers, from Black Lives Matter, from Fight for 15, that are bringing together a new call for racial, social, and economic justice in this country. And it's been a long time coming. And so that's what's so powerful about what's happening today with the new working class. It is starting to stake a claim and make a demand.
Jill, thanks for the call. And Tamara, as we get ready to wrap up, one point we haven't touched on yet is when you say it's very important that what you heard when you spoke to people, one thing that they wanted to see in the working class was the restoration of dignity. Can you tell us more about what they meant and what they were looking for?
Yeah, this was one of the surprises in the interviews I did with people across the country in all kinds of different positions, is how much pride they really took in the work they did, whether they worked in the electronics department at Walmart or at Rally's, which is a burger chain, or as a home health aide. They took great satisfaction and pride in their work, and that simply was not reflected back to them in the workplace in terms of the arbitrary discipline and favoritism and unstable schedules to society in terms of their needs not being addressed in the public sphere. And so the return to dignity, I think, is a really important piece of the demands that are being made now. And wages are just one piece of restoring dignity to working class jobs.
Tamara, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tamara Drought is the vice president of the think tank Demos, and she joined us now to talk about her new book. It's called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And you can find an excerpt from her book and weigh in. Tell us what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page.